On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Cities are a challenge to maintain, even when they're not real.
The sculpture attracts hundreds of thousands of visitors to LACMA each year. It attracts media attention, and it attracts something else, too.
I could have never imagined the amount of dust.
Gideon Brower meets the caretakers of Metropolis 2 coming up. Before that, though, a look at our metropolis. This is the last DNA of 2015, so we thought we'd take stock of what mattered this year in design and architecture in LA. And here are a few of the voices that we heard from.
It's reclamation of millions of gallons of water that are wasted that could have a significant impact on the drought problem that we're facing.
Edie and I consider it privileged to make this gift of our museum and collection to the people of Los Angeles.
It's this building, this sort of strips of sailing metal undulating all over the corner of Fairfax and Wilshire. I hate it, but I have to admire its chutzpah.
This gentleman has been called the Elon Musk of China. He's young, intelligent, and entrepreneurial, and has a strong desire to build electric vehicles. He's already announced that he's developing an electric car in China called Le Supercar.
We sometimes think of bike share as being bike rental, and it's not really bike rental. It is part of the transportation.
The old infrastructure system was built with people being the problem. This one takes us to the new day where we are all participants, where we're all managers of the water.
What we're witnessing now is really residences which are, for all intents and purposes, empty. They may be furnished, they may have art in them, but they're really just being used to park money.
What the teams have been great at doing is illustrating, you know, how important this square can be, not only to downtown Los Angeles, but to the entire city.
New developments at the LA River, the opening of the Broad and the Peterson Museum, the launch of a new e-car company, and Santa Monica's new bike share program, changing attitudes to water capture and global money flowing into expensive empty houses, and possibly a new Pershing Square. These were some of the stories on the front burner this year, but we wanted to know what else mattered. So we turned to a few of our experts.
My name is Mallory Roberts Morgan, and I'm a design writer and curator. I'm also the correspondent for Architectural Digest France here in Los Angeles. And I think one of the big stories for 2015 was really the continued ascension of Los Angeles as the city of cool creativity. And this being the city that the groovy Brooklynites are leaving Brooklyn for.
The other side of that coin is that as LA gets discovered, as more and more people come in, so does the price of living go up here, which in a way becomes a deterrent to some of the creatives, especially the young generation of creatives. And there is a bit of a sense among people who've been here longer, perhaps, that maybe something of the old easy LA life is being somewhat diminished by this global embrace of LA. Do you feel that at all?
Yes. I lived in Paris and London for over 20 years and moved to LA 7 years ago. And in that 7 years, I've seen so much change in a good way. But even in my neighborhood, I'm beginning to see so much development and, you know, the disruption of the quality of life that we have here. And even where I live in the flats of Beverly Hills, which is really a very quiet residential community. The skyline is being changed as we speak with these huge condo towers that are being built. And this new development in Century City at the Century Plaza was just passed last week. Yes, they're preserving the beautiful 1970s architecture of the Century Plaza Hotel, But the compromise is that they're building two huge towers behind it and the traffic that that's going to create. So it's all changing before our eyes. And yes, we are losing certain lifestyle quality here in Los Angeles due to this.
I'm Darren Gold. I am the chairman of the board of the West Hollywood Design District and a retail and branding consultant. For me, this year, one of the big stories was the closing of Kitson, all 17 Kitsons and their online presence as well. And it marks the end of the era of shopping by celebrity. It really is sort of part of the whole millennial movement of people want real stories about the products they're buying. People want to know where they came from, how they were made, and they don't necessarily care that a celebrity bought the product.
For anyone that might not have gone through the doors of Kitson, give us a little brief description of that store and that concept.
So Kitson was a store that was really big in the aughts, that had lots of starlets, celebrities shopping there, and would always be in the paparazzi and sort of use that as part of their branding and their way of getting people in there. And it had a global presence. People that visited LA, Kitson would be on the first stop on their list. And I actually, for the first time, purchased some things there this week because they're having a huge sale. So for Christmas gifts, since it's that time of year, it's a great place to go because everything's on sale through the end of January.
And again, for people not familiar with Kitson, what can they purchase there?
It has gifts, beauty products, clothing, kids' games, kids' books. You name it, it's there. It's a little bit of a Moroccan bazaar. It's very plastic. It's very bright, flashy. I mean, they were really well known for sort of the messaging t-shirt. You know, you go in there right now, and even on the sale, I saw a shirt that said Netflix and chill, which people don't want that anymore. No one wants a t-shirt that you can wear once and you'll have to throw it away because the message is so specific, and once you post it on Facebook, you can never wear it again. And one of the interesting things is the product that was carried at Kitson, which was sort of an export of American culture, was mostly not made in America, and it was made of, you know, more cheap materials, and for those cheap materials, you might pay $150 for one of those messaging t-shirts.
I'm Marissa Gluck, and I write about architecture, design, technology, urbanism, you name it. I think one thing that is sort of shaping the urban fabric in Los Angeles is the emergence of private membership clubs, which is not something that most Angelenos have ever been familiar with previously. There's the Jonathan Club and the California Club, which have always been seen as this sort of like older
bastion of white male privilege.
That's one way to put it. You know, in the meantime, there's been a wave of newer membership clubs like Soho House, like Noia House, like the LA Athletic Club that has opened a club within a club, 40 Ocean. It seems like every week there is another one popping up or they're expanding. So you have Soho House in West Hollywood. They're now opening in the Arts District and rumored to be opening in Malibu. So they seem to be taking over Los Angeles. So it's interesting to see what is essentially an East Coast and European style of socialization happening now in Los Angeles. And I think it speaks to a couple of changes in LA and sort of the larger world. And these are things like a influx of global capital to Los Angeles. You have a diaspora of people from the East Coast and from Europe living here now who want that style of entertainment and nightlife. And you have, I think, technology that drives a lot of that. I think people in a lot of their day-to-day feel relatively isolated. They spend their day on their phone, in their car, on email, and providing a physical location for interaction becomes, I think, more and more important as people start to feel alienated via technology. And there's opportunity for places like Soho House and Noia House to fulfill that need for people here.
We should just differentiate a little bit between the two. Soho House is a drinking and eating and meeting club. Noia House, which has some of the same people behind it, Noia House based in Hollywood, is a shared workspace, but there's a level of exclusivity to it. As I understand it, it's kind of friends place. You have to apply. There's kind of curators of who gets a space. And actually, when I went around there, I was told that the point of Noia House was to bring together sort of super interesting creative people, filmmakers, documentary makers, painters, this and that. And the idea is that everybody
gets to mesh their talents and co-create. And I did say, you know, what about a very interesting plumber? You know, would that person be eligible for entry? Or is there something, are they trying to sort of create a kind of exclusive cohort of so-called creatives?
These clubs do tend to hearken back to ideas of privilege that have never really been that persistent in Los Angeles. You know, Hollywood was created by scrappy upstarts. The technology scene here also tends to be scrappy upstarts. So that sort of DIY scrappiness that we've seen in Los Angeles's culture does seem incongruous with the rise of private membership clubs. That said, they're really effective at how they market themselves, especially playing to the needs of the creative class, whatever that means. Very often doesn't mean a really interesting plumber, but it does mean a really interesting lawyer and a really interesting coder or engineer or a really interesting writer. And when you walk into these spaces, they're really well done. They're quite beautiful. They're very comfortable. They're congenial. It's hard to hate them when you're in those spaces as much as you might want to. And you start to understand why people are willing to risk their dignity to get into them.
Do you think people are risking their dignity to get into them?
Absolutely. They're risking their dignity. I mean, they don't have to tell everybody they're rejected, but they're definitely risking their dignity when there's the possibility that, you know, they may be able to afford a private jet, but they can't get into a, you know, $1,500 a year Soho house.
I'm John Christensen. I'm on the faculty of the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA, and I'm editor of Boom, a Journal of California. 2015 was the year that the California story of dealing with climate change became the global story. And it's really a credit to Governor Jerry Brown, using the bully pulpit of the governor's office to paint, on the one hand, an apocalyptic vision of the future that could come if we don't deal with climate change, if we don't deal with global warming, if we don't cut carbon emissions dramatically. And at the same time, the genius of his communication was that giving people concrete things that they could do and connecting it to things that we see in our daily lives, the drought, wildfires throughout California throughout the summer. And guess what? We stepped up. We reduced our water consumption in cities all across California, including Los Angeles, by a quarter. And I think that is the genius of the California way that I call sunny with a chance of apocalypse.
I know, John, that you're very interested in kind of the narrative that surrounds the environmental story. Do you think, in terms of Jerry Brown, there was a pivotal moment when that photo appeared of him standing on that mountaintop that should have had snow?
Yes, and here's the thing. I moderated a conversation with Jerry Brown about a year and a half ago, which was a private conversation at Stanford University, where he was talking about the threat of nuclear war and climate change. And he said that it's crucial for leaders to put these threats in front of the people, but it's not the way that normal politics happens, that it's, you know, about satisfying people's needs this year or next year or maybe in 5 years, but not thinking about what kind of world do we want to live in 2050. And he said that he wasn't ready to talk about it until after the re-election. But after the re-election, it was like the leash was off and he was talking about it and he was going up to that meadow and telling the story of connecting climate change to the things that we're seeing. But the genius is then connecting it to a story about what we can do about it. I do hope that, you know, other leaders in California, in Los Angeles, will really see the genius of what he's doing and find a way to bring that kind of storytelling into our normal politics.
I wonder if it helps that he was raised Jesuit. And the Catholic tradition is good at apocalyptic stories as well as ways in which you can fix them.
For sure. I think his Jesuit training has a lot to do with how he thinks about eschatology, the end times, and he reads and thinks about these things seriously. This conversation we had at Stanford was with a French philosopher named Jean-Pierre Dupuis, who wrote a book called The Mark of the Sacred, which was all about how these kinds of apocalyptic narratives function by taking something very threatening kind of outside of ourselves and so that we're forced to figure out a way to deal with them. It's very kind of philosophical outlook, but, you know, Jerry Brown read the book and then invited Jean-Pierre Dupuis up to Sacramento and spent 8 hours or more talking with him. You know, that's that kind of Jesuit training and that kind of intellectual training and engagement with big ideas that, again, you know, I'm afraid is unique, and, you know, we need more of it.
Are you suggesting then that other political leaders, be it, you know, President Obama at the local level, Mayor Garcetti, that somehow they're not quite as effective as Governor Brown in communicating the importance of rising to the challenge of climate change?
I've not seen other political leaders here in Los Angeles or in California, in the United States, or in the world embrace the power of this kind of narrative and of, you know, putting the threat in front of us squarely and then showing ways that we can step up. And aside from one other, and that's Pope Francis.
Back to the Catholics.
Yes.
Jesuits, to be precise. Well, inadvertently, John Christensen, you have turned this into a Christmas story.
Indeed. And Merry Christmas.
And happy holidays. That was John Christensen, editor of Boom magazine and professor in the Department of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He was talking about Governor Jerry Brown's impact on action on climate change from California to Paris.
I am Governor Jerry Brown. My arm smiles and never frowns.
I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, you won't find a new architectural ism at Chicago's Architecture Biennial. But Gideon Brower does find the dust gathering on LACMA's Metropolis 2.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcast you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. In a moment, we'll hear about the challenges of maintaining a model city. Before we get to that, though, we'll consider real cities. If you happen to be in the Chicago area for the holidays, you might want to go check out the first Chicago Architecture Biennial. It's called the State of the Art of Architecture, and it features projects, many conceptual, by 120 architects, artists, filmmakers, dancers, selected from over 30 countries on 6 continents. And you won't find there much imagery of headliner museums or showy building skins or ever higher skyscrapers. This is not a show about the so-called starchitect. Rather, you'll find there images of a workspace reimagined with no regular desks and chairs. You'll see a police station repositioned as a community centre and an adventure playground that has been created with kids in a low-income Scottish neighbourhood. The co-artistic director of the biennial is Sarah Herder.
If I was to sum up the state of the art of architecture right now, I would say it's diversity. It's not about one kind of ideological project. This isn't another ism, modernism, postmodernism. It's really a kind of heterogeneous field. I would say one thing that while we didn't choose a specific theme or a ism, there were different shared concerns that started to emerge. One thing that really stood out was the agency of the architect and architects really carving out new ways to practice. So it's kind of challenging the notion that an architect is sitting at a desk waiting for the phone to ring and a client. There are a lot of the projects that we show in the biennial are self-initiating projects. They're kind of identifying something in the world and employing architecture and design to address specific issues.
Now, there is a British group that does embody exactly what you've just laid out, and that's the group Assemble, and they have just been awarded the prestigious Turner Prize, which is typically given to an artist. It's a very important award for contemporary art. And here you have an architecture group that has generated its own socially oriented collective design projects that are trying to take action in sort of blighted parts of England. Would you say in a way that that choice vindicates your approach?
You know, Assemble is like something like 16 partners. It's completely horizontally organized. That it's a really a kind of, I think that it represents a really new way of working. And I do think that they embody, their practice embodies a lot of the sort of spirit that you can find in other participants in the biennial.
As you know, there's certain people in the field who think architecture's pretty much exclusively about building, and you had a, you know, criticism leveled from the Zaha Hadid office. What would you say to those that critique the show on the grounds that it is not sufficiently and exclusively about built form?
Well, I mean, it is also about built form. There's such a wide range of work. I mean, it may, you know, I'm not sure if you can be everything to everyone, so that it may be more of a reflection of what they're interested in.
So to the extent there is something going on globally, one might say it's an issue of scale. We're seeing cities turning into megalopolises. We're seeing global finance being pelted into colossal skyscraper projects. But largely, you've selected projects that have a delicacy of scale, it seems to me.
We were actually really interested in this issue of scale, like at what, and looking at offices like Assemble, or maybe Roof, Rural Urban Framework, which is based in Hong Kong, which are doing small projects in rural China. At what scale can change happen? It can happen at the scale of a single building. Cities are made up of the basic unit of a building, and the ways in which these different architects are enacting change at this scale in which they, you know, that maybe doesn't require the financial backing, the systems, et cetera, behind it, that you can kind of have a self-initiated project at the scale of a single building that could change the larger environment in which it exists.
That was Sarah Herder. She's co-artistic director of the Chicago Architecture Biennial, which closes on January 3rd, 2016. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Southern California's big project right now is how to become a smooth, functioning, multimodal megalopolis. Well, it turns out that's a challenge even in a model city. Gideon Brower got a look at the day-to-day workings of Metropolis 2.
Metropolis 2, the enormous kinetic sculpture by the late artist Chris Burden, is designed to evoke the sound, speed, and energy of a modern city. 1,100 toy-sized cars and another 13 trains and trolleys whiz perpetually through an urban landscape of apartment buildings, office blocks, and skyscrapers up to 12 feet high. The sculpture attracts hundreds of thousands of visitors to LACMA each year. It attracts media attention, and it attracts something else, too.
I could have never imagined the amount of dust.
Allison Walker was part of the team that built Metropolis 2. Now she works for LACMA, operating and maintaining it, which means dealing with some of the same challenges full-size cities face every day. For one thing, LACMA's mini-city has its own version of air pollution. It's a fine powder generated by the cars as they rub against the plastic roadways. Museum patrons, you and me basically, are the other gross polluters here, especially in the winter.
Everybody's wearing woolly sweaters and scarves, and that just ends up in the air and then settles onto the sculpture.
Like tiny versions of the wayward mattresses and sofas that somehow find their way onto LA's freeways, Those fibers and grit can cause some commuting headaches.
The trains get really fussy if they have dust in their wheels.
Fussy trains are just the start of this city's transportation woes. Cars collide, break down, and go sailing off roadways. Traffic backs up. There's not much crime in this metropolis, but there are infrastructure problems and urban decay.
We are frequently gluing stone tiles back on buildings that have fallen off from the vibration.
The roads need constant maintenance and cleaning.
Mark Gilberg is director of conservation for LACMA. He says after 4 years in operation, part of one roadway has already had to be replaced.
The cars wear a groove in the track, and it's really pronounced as it goes around the curve. The cars tend to hit the sidewall, and it scrapes it. So it's a lot like the Royal Parkway.
Allison Walker is just one of a few people trained to operate the sculpture, which has to be one of the odder jobs in Los Angeles. For her, it means putting on safety glasses and a jumpsuit.
Because it's the most practical and comfortable.
Kicking off her shoes.
We don't want to mar the wooden surface.
And wriggling into the depths of the artwork. Surrounded by skyscrapers, highways, and hundreds of onlookers, she switches on the sculpture's motors, monitors traffic, and fends off other hazards.
I've had to make eye contact with a couple kids and let them know nicely that they shouldn't be touching anything.
Even with earplugs, the sound in this mini city is relentless.
There is a clunking noise that happens when the cars speed into the infeed and bump into the cars that have already stopped. There's a clacking sound that happens as the cars go around the turns. They hit the sidewall and slide around. Some of the trains make a little buzzing noise, their miniature motor working really hard. We have a vacuum and a lot of different brush attachments for the vacuum.
Metropolis 2 gets a full cleaning on Wednesdays when the museum is closed. Walker operates her own tabletop auto repair shop and train yard right there in the gallery.
This is an example of two cars. Each has had one wheel fall off. And what I'm going to do is switch the parts around. So we'll end up with one car that is missing two wheels and one car that is going to be ready to go back on the sculpture. There are two screws that hold the chassis to the body of the car. Once I take that chassis off, and I can just do the old switcheroo. Voila.
Mark Gilberg says Metropolis 2 could be any major city, New York or Cairo, or of course Los Angeles. But for all the ways that it resembles a real metropolis, there is one key difference. The sculpture has an off switch.
It's on for an hour, it's off for an hour, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, 4 to 5 times a day.
That off time is when Allison Walker answers museum patrons' questions, retrieves stray cars, and for just a few minutes, leaves the city behind.
It does feel good to put your feet up or to get some sunshine on your face.
For DNA, I'm Gideon Brown.
I'm Frances Anderton. You've been listening to DNA. The show's producer is Avishai Artsy. This show was mixed by Jennifer Swatek. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA at kcrw.com/DNA blog and follow us on our Facebook page at kcrwdna. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you have a very happy holiday.